Ruins in western China indicate that the region known as Tibet has been inhabited for at least 4,000 to 5,000 years, with evidence of modern humans in the area dating back at least 20,000 years. While the Tibetan Plateau has been inhabited since prehistoric times, most of Tibet's history went unrecorded until the introduction of Tibetan Buddhism around the 6th century. According to Tibetan legend, the Tibetan people originated from the union of a monkey and a female deity. The creation myth states that long ago, the world was covered by water, which eventually started to evaporate, when to the flooded land of Tibet came a simian hominin that had withdrawn there to immerse himself in meditation and to follow a life of asceticism and chastity. Asceticism means a lifestyle characterized by abstinence from sensual pleasures, such as refraining from expelling the male vital essence and separating the act from the orgasm itself, which is harnessed and transmuted for the purpose of pursuing spiritual goals. One day, while he sat in meditation, a female Buddhist goddess called Tara, or in some versions, a female demon, came to sexually seduce him. She threatened that if he refused to sleep with her, she would visit a demon and conceive a multitude of small monsters that would destroy all living creatures. So he agreed, and a few months later, 6 small hybrids were born of their union, which grew up in a forest, rapidly growing to a population of 500, consuming all the fruits until they could no longer be sustained. This led to a Buddhist god teaching the simian father to cultivate barley and other cereals, which led to the advent of agriculture and the ability to sustain the growing hybrid population of children. They started to use stone tools, made clothes, built houses, and formed a civilization from which the Tibetan people allegedly descend. Incidentally, it is interesting to note that wheat, rice, and corn were not originally edible foods. In other words, none of the precursors of those grains we know were edible, yet somehow were developed into staple foods, as a result allowing for large populations to subsequently flourish. That said, in regards to the legend, while amphibians, fish, plants, and yeast can sometimes produce viable offspring despite having a different number of chromosomes, this is not thought to be the case with mammals, as mammals with different number of chromosomes cannot produce fertile offspring, which is the case with offspring of donkeys and horses, for example. So the fact that all monkeys and apes have 48 chromosomes and humans have 46 chromosomes, it makes us entirely different animals than monkeys and apes, and therefore unlikely, to the best of my current understanding, that a viable offspring could be created. If there's any truth to the legend, it is much more likely that the forest population represented an archaic species of hominin, which mated with another hominin species having the same number of chromosomes, as is the case with Cro-Magnon and, let's say, Neanderthals, Denisovans, or Homo erectus. This is also likely the case with the Hindu myths about Hanuman and a population of simian forest dwellers that are also depicted as monkeys, which allegedly were used by the gods to help build Rama's bridge, an allegedly man-made stone bridge in Sri Lanka that is described in the Indian epic of Ramayana, penned thousands of years ago. There are also many other examples in Greek mythology where gods and mortals mate, as well as in the Sumerian epic of Gilgamesh, not to mention passages in the Bible describing offspring created by the mating of sons of God with the daughters of man. It's fascinating to speculate if there's truth to the ancient myths, particularly in regards to Tibet, as they describe habitats that are rarely considered in modern mainstream academia. One example are the numerous subterranean kingdoms where deep underground caverns are inhabited by people, such as the fabled inner earth realm of Agartha, a legend championed by German organizations such as the Thule Society, as well as the German nationalist government in the 30s and 40s, which traveled to Tibet at the invitation of the Dalai Lama, where they encountered initiates that shared with them esoteric knowledge from this allegedly hidden Aryan kingdom and its extensive network of inhabited tunnels. Madame Helena Blavatsky and her Theosophical Society had also drawn on ideas about Shambhala and other inner earth theories in her teachings, which claimed that races that dwelled inside of the earth's crust were custodians of a vast array of esoteric knowledge concerning human spiritual potential, especially in regards to the harnessing and transmutation of bioelectromagnetic energy, known in the East as prana or chi, and in Germanic occult societies as vril. This brings us to the Sakya Monastery, the seat of the Sakyapa sect, one of the four major schools of Tibetan Buddhism, which houses a library of 40,000 manuscripts handwritten in Tibetan, Sanskrit, Chinese, and Mongolian on a wide range of subjects such as medicine and philosophy. That said, in 2003, it has been reported that a secret library was discovered behind a wall of statues in the monastery that revealed a staggering additional 84,000 ancient texts going back several hundred years and allegedly recording up to 10,000 years of human history. While this figure may certainly be an exaggeration, the monastery itself is 1,000 years old and does exist in Tibet, as does the library, which does indeed hold 84,000 texts. The Sakya tradition holds a wealth of tantric doctrines and practices, of which the most secretive are highly sexual in nature, as they deal with the life force energy directly, the sacred vital essence of the universe itself. Some of the texts refer to the kingdom of Zhangzhung from around 500 BC, which was the precursor of later Tibetan kingdoms and the originators of the Bon religion, which is a form of ancient shamanistic magic that, according to Madame Helena Blavatsky, was the closest religion to the original ancient Aryans.
And this is what Blavatsky explained, is that the Aryans were responsible for the spread of Bon shamanism, which is, she says, in her language, is that it's the only true inheritance of the ancient Aryan tradition of magic. And that Bon shamanism then feeds into Tibetan Buddhism. So Tibetan Buddhism is not Buddhism. It's a heretical, very mystical branch of Buddhism. That's very closely connected to the Agartha myth. The Aryan race is a Kabbalistic concept, despite the fact that it's perceived as white supremacist. It's basically rooted in Scottish Rite Freemasonry. That seems to be what the underlying core is. So the basis of its ideology is this concept of the Asian Kabbalah. So it's the idea that the Kabbalah didn't originate amongst the Jews. It originated before them, long before them, amongst the Aryans. And the Aryans lived on Atlantis, where they interbred with the sons of God of the Bible. They interbred with them and created a race, a superior race known as the Aryans. And to them, they taught the so-called ancient wisdom. When this is supposed to have taken place at the time of Genesis, the time of the flood. So the sinking of Atlantis is supposed to be the flood. The Aryans escape, land in the mountains of Asia. And from there, they spread the various parts of the world and they spread their ancient wisdom.
The legend of Shambhala is said to date back thousands of years, and references to the mythical land can be found in various ancient texts. The Bon scriptures speak of a closely related land where peace and joy are the fabric of being. Hindu texts such as the Vishnu Purana mention Shambhala as the birthplace of Kalki, the final incarnation of Vishnu, who will usher in a new era. However, the text in which Shambhala is most extensively discussed is the Kala Chakra, where it is said that only those who are karmically worthy may enter. The 14th Dalai Lama noted during the 1985 Kala Chakra initiation that, quote, "We can only say that it is a pure land in the human realm. And unless one has the merit and the actual karmic association, one cannot actually arrive there." Shambhala, or Shangri-La, is said to be the land of a thousand names. It has been called the Forbidden Land, the Land of White Waters, Land of Radiant Spirits, Land of Living Fire, Land of the Living Gods, and Land of Wonders. While it appears in Buddhist legends, the myth predates Buddhism and was known to the Chinese as Si Tian, the Western Paradise of Si Wang Mu, and to the Russian Old Believers, it is known as the Kingdom of Epona. Old Believers refers to Eastern Orthodox Christians that maintain ritual practices as they were before the year 1666. Madame Blavatsky claimed that ancient Aryans inhabited parts of Asia in antiquity, and nearly a century after her death, tall blonde-haired mummies started turning up in the deserts of China, dating back 4,000 years, centuries before any East Asian people inhabited the area. While the Chinese communist government tries to downplay these ancient Aryan mummies with Caucasian features, they also do their best to hide the numerous pyramids which litter the Chinese landscape by planting rows of trees on them in an effort to make them less visible from above. They can still be made out, however, using Google Earth, aligned exactly as the pyramids of Egypt are, with the familiar top point missing. Blavatsky claimed that much of their ancient sacred knowledge survived hidden as symbols in many modern religions, but is misunderstood by the majority of the public. Shambhala's location and nature remains a subject of much dispute, and several traditions have arisen as to where it is, including those that emphasize it as a non-physical realm that one can approach only through the mind.
Which brings us back to the Sakya Library and the wealth of ancient wisdom from the Orient that has been faithfully preserved and is now being made available to the West. Orient is a term for the East in relation to Europe, the direction from which the ancient Aryans originated from during the Holocene, whose esoteric knowledge is being rediscovered after having been inaccessible to non-initiates for centuries, if not millennia. One of the Taoist practitioners making such occult knowledge available is Master Montauk Chia, author of the book The Multi-Orgasmic Male, and 60 other books concerning inner alchemy and energy transmutation.
All the animal, every living thing have electricity flow inside. Now the Western doctor discovered that now that if you have more electricity in your body, you're healthier. When you have less electricity inside your body, you're getting weaker or sick. And all the germ and disease are very easy to come into you. That's how. Now in the 4,000-5,000 years ago, they have no electricity concept. But when they meditate, they feel something moving inside the body. So the Tao give a name called Qi. Qi, like the steam. That's it. Okay? Now, we know now that two circuit is the yin and yang circuit, like the electricity, yin and yang flow. And when you can get this yin and yang flow up and flow down, you started to get a balance inside you. You started to get a balance. So the yang flow up and the yin flow down. So this way you're increasing the electricity. With this alone, a lot of sickness can be healed.
What he's describing here is a method of circulating bioelectromagnetic energy in the body, which is achieved by first retaining rather than expelling one's vital essence through climax, and then harnessing the energy and redirecting it upwards instead of out, refining and transmuting carnal energy into creative or spiritual life force energy that is called qi in Taoist philosophy.
Physically, we need energy. And mentally, we need energy. Spiritually, we need energy. We need food. So we say, physically need food, mentally we need food, spiritually we need food. Okay? But a lot of people, all they do is this only, food. That's all. But what about the rest? The air we breathe, the water we drink? Now more and more people talk more aware of the air they breathe and the water they drink. Okay? But not many people know about the heaven, the earth force, and the sexual energy.
The same way that food is consumed and digested to nourish the physical vehicle, mental, emotional, and spiritual nourishment is also required to feed the energetic system, which, if neglected, can atrophy or remain underdeveloped. This means being mindful of the types of media one consumes, the books we read, the music we listen to, the company we keep, and the environments that we submerse ourselves in. Living with social integrity and balance in our personal relationships also has an impact on our spiritual well-being, as well as proper management of our vital energetic essence. That said, the ultimate goal of internal alchemy is not only improved health, vitality, and a fulfilling and happy life, but allegedly prepares one for the afterlife.
How can we condense our life force to be condensed and not dispersed and draw by any other thing? Especially on the moment of death. What happened to them on the moment of death? All their soul and spirit and life force is gathered all around. Not there anymore. The real purpose on the first level is concentrate, gather your energy, refine your energy, so all the soul and spirit energy and the body energy all condense, become one energy and cannot be dispersed, cannot be attracted, cannot be side pulled by anything, not the worldly thing or not anybody. You are so concentrated, you become yourself. Your energy is so condensed and your energy is just right there. It happens if you need to lose, to left this world. Your energy is so condensed and you gather all the energy and you go at one piece.
The retention, harnessing, amplification, and transmutation of the life force energy is alchemically expressed as an internal unification of energetic polarities, articulated by Taoists as yin and yang, which combine into a third energy, which is symbolically represented as a spiritual or etheric child.
And you, so when you do that way and you started to really mixing these two energy into one, right, and it started to form to another body. Uh-huh. Or we call, you inject a seed of the soul or the spirit into the immortal energy, the jing energy, it give life to the another body. That means we grow the soul and the spirit.
Can you feel this happening inside you?
Yes.
What do you feel?
When you turn in your mind in, you feel another life within life.
You feel life growing inside.
Building the life, yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And you can feel them, you can actually aware of it, and it will happen inside you.
So after you grow this body, then what happens after this expansion?
So we call you transfer the consciousness, you transfer your awareness into it. So like a piece of wood, if you burn them, it turns to be heat.
Right.
But it disappears.
Right.
Okay? Now, in physically, we cannot do anything. But when you turn it into chi, you can transform. And you can take that.
Uh-huh. You take the chi.
You can take it. Like if you your heart is physically, but when you turn your heart to a pure love, uh-huh. it becomes another energy. Mm-hmm. But the energy, if you don't do anything, it disperses. Mm-hmm. But if you have a container, you put it in, it stays. Mm-hmm. So that's why you need to build a body first. And when you have love, joy, happy, whatever you have, you want to store them, you can put in the body.
And then, of course, you have to have the emotional connection there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But once you have this immortal body, let's say it grows, mm-hmm. then what do we do with this human experience?
The whole thing is that we call the immortal body, you transfer whatever the physical thing to another body. And when you want to leave the world, you take whatever you transfer and left.
You so leave body, with your body. You transform the body into life.
Another body.
Right.
And your consciousness also go into that body.
Right.
So that body is not dying, but this body are dying.
Right.
So you have to change the dying one into the one not dying, mm-hmm. and you can take it out. So oftentimes in the Tamasa, when they practice to a level, when they left the world, sometimes the body shrink down half of it because they take out a lot of things.
Uh-huh.
That's the same thing like Jesus practiced. Well, after he died for 3 days, mm-hmm. his body dissolved and disappeared.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So how long does it take to build the immortal body? Like someone like who's been practicing?
Actually, 3 years, you do in the first 3 years, you started to prepare it. And when you get pregnant, we don't know when.
You get pregnant with your own immortal seed.
Nobody know when.
Yes.
But when you keep on doing that, one day you get pregnant. Okay.
Are you pregnant?
A man pregnant sometimes not very good, huh? Okay. Now, when you get pregnant, you need to feed them or nurture them 3 years.
The Taoist masters were able to do this and then leave with their immortal body.
Right.
So this is the ultimate practice of cultivating the sexual energy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I see. So how do you ever ejaculate though? I mean, or is
oh yeah, sometimes. I mean, I have children, but that is what ejaculation. But if not, I'm not ejaculation.
To help illustrate the point further, I'd like to close with a brief excerpt from the teachings of Samuel Einweyer, available on Glorian.org, which articulates the same esoteric information, but from a Kabbalistic and Christian Gnostic perspective, to highlight the universal nature of this occult material as it was passed down since antiquity from the same source, only veiled through different symbolism, but expressing the same hidden meaning.
Through their union, and performed with love and not lust, by conserving that precious energy of creativity, volatility of Genesis, they give birth to something truly divine, meaning thou shalt not fornicate, meaning do not waste your creative sexual energy. Do not lose that force because you need to give birth and create inside with it, as we're going to elaborate. This is symbolized by water. And if you study the Bible and many mythologies, water is the source of life, not just physically, but also spiritually. It is a symbol of our creative genesiatic, spiritual, sexual energy. It is what can give the potential of creation into something actual, realized. When we raise the fire of Pentecost, the fire of the Holy Spirit within the spine, within successive octaves, within different internal bodies, we can say, vehicles of the soul, which operate within the different dimensions of the tree of life, that energy helps us to crucify our ego. And this is the Kundalini serpent fire, which Moses raised upon a staff in the wilderness, the bronze serpent, which is the power of the Holy Spirit. And in that way, a person resurrects within fire, that creative energy. when you raise the creative force, if you study the writings of Sambal and Vior extensively, in The Perfect Matrimony especially, you find that that fire gives birth to spiritual bodies, spiritual vehicles, which we can operate with when we physically go to sleep and enter the internal world. These are vehicles much in the same way that a light bulb is a vehicle for expressing light. We call them solar bodies. So we're going to elaborate a few specifics relating to the resurrection of the astral body for people who are learning to work in The Perfect Matrimony and who are seeking to create the solar vehicles themselves, in which a married couple combines their sexual force with purity and with love, transforming it and conserving it and raising it within the spine in order to give birth to the soul.
My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description. Please subscribe for future updates. Leave your thoughts below. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.